We're gonna get started. So last class I spent some time talking about operating systems and why we think we need operating systems. But to qualify for an operating system, what we are talking about is some piece of software that exists somewhere on a machine. We'll have to unravel the mysteries. And this operating system must be capable of handling the CPU. And by that, I mean, the evolution, of course, said that the CPU is the most important, crucial, and expensive piece of hardware that we can have. And hence, we have to extract as much work out of it as possible in the minimum amount of time. It doesn't matter that all that is not true anymore, but we still want to extract as much work out of a CPU in the minimal amount of time because that leads to faster running of the system. And everybody is still worried about speed. How fast does your computer boot up? Does it run that application immediately when you click it? Or any kind of key clicks, etc., is immediately responded to? So speed is something that we like, and hence the same set of mechanisms that they invented 40 years ago is still used to perform the same thing. So this management I want some software that takes care of allocating the CPU to different tasks that we call processes and do it in some efficient manner, do it as optimally as possible. Now, optimal means that's the best way to do it. However, it is provably can be shown that you cannot do CPU management optimally. It's not possible. So as close to optimal as possible, you want to do the allocation, reallocation of the CPU to different things. And, of course, lower overhead, etc. So these processes, we'll use the word process a lot, has some relevance to applications, maybe. Okay. In the task manager, we can take the applications view, which isn't that interesting. Here are the processes. These are actual different things running on the machine, and there is a lot of them. In fact, that makes it even larger. These are things that are mostly not doing anything right now, but they are loaded up. And who decides which one runs and how much does it run, etc., that's up to the CPU scheduler, which we will look at very soon. And these performance figures come here, so there's a memory issue that there's a certain amount of memory being consumed, certain amount of CPU being consumed, and all this is being handled by some software that's in there. And that's the operating system. So and simply put, memory allocation is something we programmers don't really see. It's kind of magic. We'll have to figure out what this magic is, because nothing is magic. But there is memory. There's RAM on a system. Who gets to use which part of the RAM and how much is the job of this memory manager. and it makes a bunch of decisions based on all kinds of things. Once again, it came about that memory is very expensive. That's not true anymore. Memory is very expensive. We have to allocate it very carefully to make the best use of memory. And the techniques that were developed still today apply, because even though memory is not very expensive, there is still a limited amount because of physical limitations. And this has to be allocated in such a manner that your things run efficiently and fast. You know that if you are running low on RAM, things slow down. But that's inevitable, but there is a correlation between memory and speed. So we want to be able to do that correctly. Then there are devices. Okay, every computer has a keyboard, a mouse, some sort of disks, networking, maybe printers, maybe other some special purpose gadgets attached to it. How does a programmer who's writing applications know exactly what to do to get a keystroke from a keyboard? We really don't want to know that. It's too complex. Not only that, then every application has to be written to have this code which reads keystrokes from a keyboard. Why can't we just put it in a library? Yes, that's how we do it, and that library is part of the operating system, because reading something from a keyboard requires certain special opcodes, which we'll talk about, like privileged opcodes, which cannot be put in a user-level library. So it has to be in the operating system kernel. So that's something we need to discuss. So there are devices. There could be different manufacturers, different device drivers, and all that. You know about device drivers, and those things have to be encapsulated and kept somewhere, and hence we need the operating system to do that. So the operating system I'm drawing this 3GB, 4GB, it's not necessarily there. The operating system has some amount of code and data that's called the kernel, the core thing. And this is always sitting in some part of memory. What I've drawn may not be correct. This is for a 32-bit virtual memory-enabled computer. If it's not a virtual memory-enabled computer, then it's at the top. But all computers are virtual memory enabled these days. But when we start talking about these things, we'll assume non-virtual memory computers, because it's simpler to explain. So this is where the kernel is. It consists of code and data that goes there. And so there will be a part of this stuff which contains the library that I talked about. And there'll be some data consisting of who is running. So for instance, when I show you this task manager thing, where is this information coming from? That there are tasks with those names. This is actually a snapshot of a table which is stored in the kernel, because that keeps track of what are the names of the processes running, what is it doing, how much of CPU has it used. So it's a smallish table that's in there. So it's like this. There's a whole bunch of information that needs to be kept in some central location. So that's the data in the kernel. And how do we get a hold of this piece of data from in there and display it on the screen? Well, we need some library routine that reads this, formats this, and puts it on the screen. That's how it's happening. So there's a lot more to it than, oh, okay, here's the task manager, it runs. There's an underlying something that's doing it. Okay. Little bit, not terribly important, but little bit about the view from the point of view of software. Operating system is software. It's written in partial assembly, but mainly C code. All this code makes an assumption of what the underlying CPU is. And all software assumes that the CPU is a single cycle machine. A single cycle machine, in case you forgot what it is a machine that runs one opcode per cycle. That is, if one execution of one opcode is finished, the next opcode starts running. Because your program, even if written in assembly, is just a sequence of opcodes, and it needs to run sequentially one after the other, the next opcode may depend on the result of the previous opcode, so it must be finished executing. Actually, in reality, we don't care. We are software people. In reality, however, that's not how computers work. They take large numbers of instructions all in one time and execute them in parallel. That's called pipelining. But that pipelining is not visible to anybody, not even the operating system. From the software point of view, it's a single cycle machine. So all that stuff about what you've heard of pipelining is not relevant to software, but it's very relevant from the computer organization classes or in the speed of the machine and how machines are constructed. All machines have caches. We never see these caches. Even the operating system don't. They see a part of a cache called a TLB, but generally, no. We assume there are no caches. Caches are magic that speeds up the machine. When you write a program, do you even know that there's a cache? How come you don't know? Because it's not visible to programs. There are things called stacks, but that's a software concept which programming languages try to hide that there's a stack, because you don't do any programming with stacks, it happens, but they're definitely visible from software. But caches are not visible from software. Memory can be viewed as a sequence of addresses, that's RAM addresses, and that's the view we will take initially. However, for the longest time, we haven't been using physical memory computers. We are using virtual memory computers, where these RAM addresses get completely hidden using a scheme which gives, where we use fake addresses, essentially, called virtual addresses. So we'll get to that towards the second half of the class. But so till then, we'll assume it's just addresses in memory sequentially. Devices, let's not talk about it. It's very complicated and has all kinds of strangeness depending upon manufacturer, interface, etc. Those things are visible to the operating system only, not to any kind of application programs. They're hidden by the operating system. Coming back to this virtual memory thing, the operating system does have a part which deals with setting up the virtual memory. But after that, everything runs in virtual memory, and you don't get to see much of that. Are there various kinds of operating systems? The answer is yes. But I find the distinctions rather irrelevant. Firstly, you can say, what are the types of operating systems? You'll go like Linux, Windows, iOS, etc. No, that's not what I meant. They are different brands of operating systems. And Linux and Windows is the same kind of operating system. It's a desktop operating system or a server operating system. So what kinds of operating system or types of operating systems do we have? And the two common distinction is desktop and server. All operating systems have desktop version, server version. What's the difference? It wouldn't be wrong to say nothing. It's just branding. There's minor differences in the user interface. There's minor differences in the scheduling algorithms used. But essentially, it's the same thing. But call it different. So just a few things. Again, most of these are more or less the same thing. Real time is a little different. Desktop and server, similar. Batch just means the usage of a certain machine is different. That is, it's neither a server nor a desktop. It is a machine that is used to constantly run programs on behalf of something. For example, a lot of batch processing is done by banks. They have to keep running consolidation transactions, which figure out how many credit card, take all the credit card operations and apply them to various accounts, and they run at certain periods, and or weather forecasting, or various data centers run batch applications. Data centers can be running online applications, that is, they're dealing with your email and your cloud storage and etc. But in addition to that, they do batch operations, like Google will be hunting the web for stuff and consolidating all that information. Does it matter what kind of operating system you're using for batch versus server versus desktop? No. It's just differences in applications and differences in uses. So cluster is a bunch of machines, each one running its own operating system, but they generally are the exact same version of the exact same brand of the operating system. Embedded is a little different, maybe. But embedded operating systems are converging into mostly normal operating systems. The idea behind embedded operating systems kind of was that these are used for electronic gadgets that does one thing only. A particular function. So let's say it's a computer with just one app running, and you have no way of reprogramming it, really. But, of course, evolution means that things have changed a little. The examples would be, for example, yeah?
Is Windows embedded actually an embedded OS, or is that just
a it's a little embedded OS in the sense that it has chopped off a certain set of features from Windows. But it's still pretty much a general purpose operating system, or embedded Linux, or but QNX and things like that are a little more downsized operating system. You had a question here? No? Okay. So what is an embedded operating system? Single function or specific function operating systems. There are lots and lots of computers that are used in manufacturing for process control, for tracking inventory, for something. So they just do their jobs. There are computers used in cars. Those car computers are not something that you can go play with or run commands on. They have a fixed set of functions that they do. They control the ignition system and the lighting and the whatever they do. And somebody has loaded a program onto it, and that program runs in that system. You don't change it. Microwaves, refrigerators, washing machines. Does a washing machine have a computer? Why? Timing, cycles, etc. But it didn't have computers. Oh, yeah, that's right. It had mechanical things that turned, or it had something called ASICs, which is an electronic circuit board where the circuit itself is designed to do that function. It turns out it's a lot cheaper to throw in an old generation processor on there and write a program to do it than to custom build circuits to do that. So everything that's electronic which does functions have computers in it. But those computers need programs, maybe operating systems too. So all that is embedded in the sense it's burnt into ROM once, out the door in retail, never touched again, it's supposed to work. And another thing that's becoming more and more popular where embedded, so-called embedded things are being used, but I think all of it is Linux anyway, so it's not really an embedded, but the Internet of Things. So your thermostat, like the Nest thermostat, it has a Linux operating system running. But you generally don't reprogram it, although it's possible. So that blurs the line of whether it's embedded or whether it's general purpose.
That's a key feature that a lot of IoT devices like the Nest advertise, is that they constantly are updated and improved, but it's still being classified as...
It'll still be classified because it's doing this thermostat job. It's not doing... you're not playing a game on it or sending email via it, okay? So you're not loading it up with apps, but they're updating their firmware. It used to be firmware, now it's like there's an app which does it, and then it's also somewhat learning, so it's gathering data from you, but that's part of the programming of that app. The downside of the IoTs as opposed to the computer that used to be in the car or microwave is that they're actually connected to the internet, which makes it a huge security risk because they're not very well updated often.
So when they refer to like firmware, are they kind of talking about embedded
OS? No. A firmware is there on every computer. There's more firmware in an embedded. So firmware can be two different things. Firmware is the basic device drivers and BIOS stuff that's in a general purpose computer that's resident in ROM that gets loaded up while booting the machine. Firmware can also be a program, an application that is loaded in ROM to do a particular function, like if you have, all of you probably have a router at home. So the router at home looks at all the incoming traffic from the internet provider and routes it to various ports in your, because you might have multiple computers at home. And it puts proper headers on outgoing packets and sends it out. So this is done by a program. Where is this program? It's running on that thing. But if you power it down and you power it back up, it'll boot, and instead of running a general purpose shell or GUI, it'll load up the app which does the routing, and the router function will be called the firmware. But it's really an app. So anything that's pretty much loaded up in RAM is termed firmware. It is software essentially. But it's kind of firm as in it's in ROM, not updatable. It is, but nowadays all firmware is updatable. So all of this boils down to pretty much the same set of principles of operating systems. Everything we'll talk about apply to all of them. This one's different, and we will not cover it. These guys are operating systems, which is kind of has the embedded flavor. That is, it runs a particular application or set of applications, and these applications have stringent time requirements. That is, you have to run this function in this application every 10 milliseconds. You can't be late. So there would be a specially built, custom-built scheduler which will decide, I have to do this, and then this, then this. It's all pre-programmed, and there's a dance going on in there. You cannot change anything in there. Things will break because it's very timing-related. So it's not really it won't have file systems and user input systems, but it has a bunch of tasks to do. The operating system knows exactly what the set of tasks are. Those things don't change. It has timing requirements on those tasks. The operating system also knows how long each task or program runs on that CPU, which a general purpose operating system doesn't know because it keeps changing. I mean, when you load your word processor, how long does it run on the CPU? Operating system doesn't care. It just gives it some time. Yeah?
Is that what the batch operating system was also doing?
Batch operating system is something that will run things in batches, but it doesn't know what you're running. You could be giving it financial applications or weather forecasting applications. It'll run it one by one, but it'll not generally run it one by one. It'll decide that I have 200 things to do in the batch queue, but I will not do 200 at the same time. I will pick three or four. And unlike a desktop operating system where anything you fire up runs instantly, here all the things get fired up first and then the operating system decides which ones to pick. Okay. Something to note about the peculiarity of operating systems. It's a bunch of software sitting here. So are apps or applications. Applications run. They run because of the existence of something called a process. So when you think about writing a C program or a Java program or whatever language program, there's a point at which the main routine, that's where the execution will start, and it will step through the program, it will jump to whatever function you're calling, etc. There is this thread of execution that will flow through that program. That is the process. When you run the program, that's what's going to happen, it runs. The operating system is not like that. There is no process running through the operating system. It is not an app, it's not a process, so what is it? What is it is just a bunch of code sitting here. It will actually run, it will execute, but not like an application does step by step by step. It will execute on demand. Who demands execution? The apps do. So an operating system runs only on the behalf of applications. So for instance, I'm running an application app one here, and it is threading through its instructions, and then it gets to an instruction like in C, let's say printf. That printf instruction is something, or a line, the statement is something that an application program cannot implement. It cannot be done. Why? That's all the system call and protection stuff we are trying to cover, get to. So since it cannot be done at the application level, it will generate a call, like a function call, to a routine here, which will execute it, and then it will return back. And this is called a system call. The only lie I did here was printf is not a system call. Write is a system call in Linux. But printf does a few things and then calls write. And the write system call cannot be implemented at the application level. So this thing runs in the operating system because the application was doing something. Similarly, there's lots of routines here that run because the application wanted to do something. So that's one way the operating system runs. And the other way is interrupts. Interrupts are hardware things that causes the operating system to run for a little bit of time and goes away. So the operating system steals tiny, tiny pieces of time out of the running applications and runs once in a while. It just doesn't continue running. And that's why it's not very visible to anybody. If you see system processes running, that's not the operating system. That's just processes that's doing some things. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah.
Would you say that the GUI of the operating system is also an application?
It is an application. It's completely an application. It is just marketing says, look at the GUI, this screen view, mine's much better than theirs. So my operating system is, it's just an application that's bundled with the operating system. In fact, if you're a Linux user, you have a choice of a bunch of GUIs, and they look all quite different. And if you are a Windows or Macintosh user, you're kind of given a GUI and you use that. But it can be changed. Any other questions? So yeah, we are talking about the core operating system. None of the other apps or even apps supplied with the operating system. We want to know what goes on here. So what goes on here in the simplest possible terms is it's just a bunch of functions that get called kind of randomly by interrupts or by applications running. And that's all. You have no executive powers here of something running constantly looking at the system. So it's a very background thing. But since it's done this way, we have to make sure of two or three things. One is that these things are existing in memory. None of those applications, maliciously or by mistake, should overwrite any of this. None of those applications should have any access to the data stored in here. And none of those applications should also clobber or something to do with other applications' data or code areas. So we need memory protection. And I did cover this last class, so I'll quickly go over it, that the app must use addresses that only fall between the low address here, we'll call it X, and so this is X, and this place is X plus S, where S is the size. Okay. Application must stay. Now, if I do this, it automatically means that this space is private to the application because other applications can't come in here. And since this application cannot address anything outside, it cannot access the operating system either. So which means it cannot even call the printf routine in the operating system. Oh, that's a problem. We'll have to fix that because it does need to call the... It has no access to anything outside this box except for some special stuff. Okay? How do we enforce that? This has to be completely enforced. We cannot enforce this using any kind of software because software can be circumvented. So we need to enforce this using hardware. So that's the base and bound registers we were talking about last time. Whenever an application runs, here is X, here is X plus S, so what I wrote there is MMU. It's really not the right term. But I'll stick in a simple piece of hardware that we can call a memory management unit. Between the CPU and the actual RAM memory, the application is here between X and X plus S. And there are two registers in this specially crafted MMU. which call the base and the bound register, and I put the value X and the value S in those two. And this piece of hardware just monitors the addresses coming from the CPU, and it passes on to memory. It goes untouched through the MMU. However, what's going through the bus is being looked at by the MMU, and if an address that is lower than X or higher than X plus S tries to go through, cuts it off. And does some other stuff, talks back to the CPU using an interrupt, and says, you've done something wrong. And that interrupt has to be handled by the operating system, and certain disciplinary action needs to be taken because somebody did something wrong. Okay? And that's called memory protection. But as you can see, these values X and S cannot be permanently stored in the MMU. They will have to be changed every time you run a different application, because there are lots of applications, lots of processes stored on that RAM, and they all have different base and bound values. So there has to be a method by which you change X and S. And is that method software, or is it more hardware? The answer is it's software. There are some opcodes that change the values of the registers in the MMU. If it's software, then there's a gaping hole. The application programmer can figure out how to change the values, change them, and mess with the operating system or other people's programs. That would be malicious. There are reasons why it could be just accidental also. And that should not be possible. Yeah. It is possible to change it via the software. It's not trickier, it's just opcodes. Okay? So we shouldn't make it possible to change it via software. If it's not possible to change it via software, then the operating system cannot change it. I want the operating system to be able to change it. So essentially what I'm saying, that there are things that an operating system should be able to do that a user program is unable to do. Okay, so in theory, that's how it should be. How do we make that possible in real life? Louder.
Are you referring to all operating system, like beta system, or you just towards dev stuff?
Any operating system that's an operating system will need to do this.
Okay.
So that's a function that has to be limited to operating systems. Now, for now, all we have is software opcodes, and opcodes can be used by anybody. Yeah.
So for like an embedded system, would they have an MMU at all?
They may or may not, but today's embedded systems, since these things have become cheap, they all probably have it. And it'll probably converge to some thing like Android or iOS in the coming future, which all runs on ARM processors with full-blown MMUs. This is a very stunted MMU. MMUs are much more complex than this, but this is the starting point of an MMU, that it enforces memory-bound protection. But the MMU is controlled by software opcodes, and those pieces of opcodes should not be used by applications. So how do you make sure that that doesn't happen? Yeah. Okay, now which process, and how does the hardware know that this is the process that's more golden than the others? And if somebody can tell it, I can tell it too. And I'll call myself the golden application. So it becomes a very tricky problem of how do you make sure that some things can do this and some things cannot. Okay? But let's say for somehow we have an MMU and we have loaded it up and the application can't change it, then you can see that this application can be constrained to stay between X and X plus S. Okay. However, we must make sure that this application cannot change it, and we have to make sure that this application can call the operating system, because as it stands, if it does a function call to an operating system routine, the CPU will send an address that belongs to the operating system, and the MMU will immediately squish it, and so no system calls are possible. So this is not, this is a starting point of a design, but it doesn't work. So the next piece of hardware gimmickry that's thrown in is CPU modes.
Rings, is that how it's called?
Rings. Why is it called rings? Let's go with mode. Privilege mode. User mode or privilege. The operating system should at least have two modes. Now, Intel started this thing about, no, maybe it should have four modes. And then they talk about rings, ring zero, ring one, ring two, as if they're round concentric circles and things like that. Let's use the simpler one, that's all we need. Two modes. These modes are user mode and privileged mode. What's the difference? The difference is this is the set of opcodes. CPU hardware is programmed to look at a mode bit, which is one bit in some specific register, which if it's zero, the CPU decides I'm in user mode. It's not really user, but it's called user mode, but this has got nothing to do with the human user. If you're in user mode, you will execute any opcode that's not in here. And if you encounter an opcode that's in here, you will refuse to execute it. You will throw some sort of a tantrum, and that's coming to that. So a user mode CPU, when it executes an opcode, it always, for every opcode executed, it checks the mode bit. Zero means I'm in the user mode, I'll execute any of these. If I'm in privileged mode, I just execute everything. Doesn't matter. It could be user opcodes or privileged opcodes. I'll execute anything. Okay? And this might lead to a solution that changing the MMU registers is an opcode that sits here. And hence, changing the MMU registers cannot be done in user mode, it has to be done in privileged mode. But this still doesn't solve the problem. So now we talk about, okay, so to change, the CPU has to sometimes change the mode bit. Sometimes it runs in application mode, sometimes it runs in privileged mode. How do we change the mode bit? Okay, we'll have an opcode to change the mode bit. Great. The opcode that changes the mode bit, is it a privileged opcode or a non-privileged opcode, user opcode? If it's non-privileged, then I can use that opcode and change the mode bit to privileged and execute. Okay, it's privileged. If it's privileged, once the user is in, once the CPU is in user mode, it can never change to privileged mode. So it cannot be either privileged or non-privileged. So how do we change the mode bit? It starts at privileged mode, switches to non-privileged mode is a privileged operation. I can't hear you. No, that's got nothing to do with this. That's your operating system asking you whether you want to be administrator or root, which is a username. Whatever you say, you're administrator or root or regular Joe, you still be running in application mode. Nobody is allowed to run in privileged mode other than the kernel, not even the root guy. Okay? So this switching is a low-level CPU mode selecting switch. That switch makes the CPU decide whether it's going to execute certain opcodes or not. And flipping that switch is a huge problem because we don't know how to do it, because of course it has to be done by some form of an instruction, but I can argue that this instruction cannot exist. Because if it exists, it has to be a privileged instruction or a user instruction. If it's a user instruction, then anybody can flip the switch. If it's a privileged instruction, then nobody can flip the switch, and it's useless.
So, I guess, the user program switches between messages, and operating.
Yeah, but if the operating system is always running in privileged, how does the switching happen? We still have a problem. How does the operating system run in privilege? Somebody has to switch the thing because there's one CPU. It's running in user mode right now. Yeah.
Does it start in privileged mode?
It does start in privileged mode. And then you turn it off, and then you cannot turn it back on ever again, which is not acceptable. Okay, so how do I explain how it works? This is a difficult one. Before I explain how it works, privileged mode is used for privileged instructions are used for things that applications shouldn't do. Control registers in the MMU, that's privileged. Control devices, you have a disk. Can anybody read and write to it? The answer is no. Why not? Because an application doesn't know exactly how to deal with the sectors on the disk. You should work with files. In fact, you can only write to files that are writable. Some files are read-only. How do we make sure that you don't write to read-only files? We make sure you don't write to any files. You do not touch the disk. Yeah.
Is the privilege mode used to control the memory access bounds?
Yes. It is used to control the memory access bounds. It's used to control CPU timers. It's used to control all devices. because any IoT devices, networks, etc., is off limits from applications. Otherwise, applications can do very nasty things. So all of these things, input, output, control of MMU, etc., has to be done by the operating system in privileged mode. So we need privileged mode. Without privileged mode, we cannot handle anything. So we need memory protection and we need privileged mode. And once we have both, the operating system, by turning on privileged mode and putting bounds on memory for applications, can handle everything, including system calls, which we'll wait for a little bit to get into. So now we need to solve the problem of how do we control CPU modes. There is no instruction to change CPU modes. We have to talk about how interrupts work, because there's a sneaky way the interrupts control CPU modes. Okay, an interrupt is an electrical signal that can be sent to a CPU at any point in time, regardless of what the CPU is doing. It can be an electrical signal, it can be a software signal, but let's go with an electrical signal for now. Okay? So devices send interrupts. Every time you touch a key on your keyboard, it's hardwired to send an interrupt to the CPU, because the CPU is not sitting and watching you type or not type on the keyboard. It sends a direct electrical signal to the CPU. Your mouse movements all generate interrupts. So these interrupts cause something. It causes the CPU it's kind of like a pulse. And by programmed, I mean programmed in hardware to do this. This is part of the CPU's execution strategy. And by PC, I mean program counter. So program counter, some people call it IP, instruction pointer. I call it PC. Both are correct words. I have to choose one. Program counter is the counter that does the fetch and execute cycle. So it contains the address of what you're executing. So you're executing an application. It contains the address of the next instruction that you'll execute, and we'll go from there, right? Remember that. When an interrupt happens, the CPU is kind of bumped with an electrical pulse. That causes the CPU to do a simple thing. It takes the program counter value and pushes it. What does push mean? It pushes it onto the current stack. Where is the current stack? Okay. There is a thing called the stack pointer also in the CPU. And the stack pointer is pointing to some area of memory that is called the stack. And push means take a certain value and copy it to the address that the stack pointer is pointing to. So you take whatever is in the PC and copy it to the first word here. And then you decrement the stack pointer by one. Decrement because the stack grows up to lower addresses. So that's the push operation on the stack. It's ingrained into the CPU. There's a lot of push operations that happen. So push is a well-known operation to the CPU. So if an interrupt happens, you push the CPU. Now that you've thrown the CPU onto the stack, you have to put something in the CPU in order to continue execution. So there is a specially marked area in the kernel memory called interrupt vector. Why is it a vector? I'm oversimplifying. It's not one thing. It's actually a bunch of stuff, all one after the other. But for now, let's just say there is one. And this interrupt, this value is copied to the program counter. And then the hardware goes, let's resume our business. Okay? So what will happen if we do this? So what happens when an interrupt happens? What's the outcome? Did I mention anything about modes? So it can't even switch modes. What do you think will happen if it does exactly what I said?
It executes whatever other operation that's supposed to.
It executes something else, another operation. What does it execute? I know you can't tell from this diagram, but if you had to guess, or there is some value in this interrupt vector, right? That will go into the program counter. So that will get used as the point at which the next instruction will be fetched from. And that address is not something over here. So the CPU will now, this becomes the part of the program counter. So the CPU will execute another piece of code where this guy is pointing to. And what's there, I don't know. Hopefully this is some part of operating system's code. So whenever an interrupt happens, the CPU quits doing whatever it was doing. So your straight line program suddenly stops running and the CPU goes run something else. Typically this is an operating system routine. And this routine will execute on an interrupt and then there's some magic here which says go back to where you came from. Okay? So, progressing a little bit more. So this is how it's the CPU is built, yes.
Is that the same as Go to in C?
No. You mean RTI?
Just the interrupt.
The interrupt, there's no opcode for interrupt. Oh, it's on the Intel architecture, there is a assembly opcode called INT.
Oh.
Okay, and there is nothing in C that'll do it. Yes.
So like for the interrupt vector that kind of directs it, does that not get like scanned by like the MMU?
Yeah, it does, but we haven't kind of figured out how to do modes yet. So let's assume there are no modes. Next step is to patch this interrupt handling with modes. And then we'll shut off the MMU in the process. because it looks like that'll immediately get trapped by the MMU. Yeah. So moment the interrupt happens, you have loaded an address from the interrupt vector, wherever that is, and it contains something, whatever it is, the hardware will blindly load it into the program counter and push the old value of the program counter into the stack. And then this interrupt handler routine executes. It's a straight line piece of code, it executes. And then at the end of that interrupt handler routine, it's mandatory that you put in an RTI instruction. You know, in assembly programming, there's a return instruction. It is very similar to that, but it does a few other things. So it's different from the return instruction. But right now, it looks exactly like a return instruction. It pulls out an item from the stack, increments the stack pointer, so that's why it pops a value off of the stack, and puts it into the program counter. Hence, the program counter value gets restored to wherever, whatever it was, and the original program continues execution as if nothing has happened. So you just kind of steal a few cycles away from the application that's running to run an interrupt handler. So that's the theory. It doesn't mean anything about what is this interrupt handler, what does it do? We haven't talked about that. But there is this mechanism built into the CPU which allows the CPU to run an interrupt handler whenever there's an external interrupt. Now we are going to modify this interrupt handling with some more features that will enable us to do mode switching. Okay? So in the CPU, I have the program counter, I have the stack pointer, and I have another register, which is, I will call it PS. And Intel calls it flags. Is the flags register or the PS program status register? This is another one of those invisible registers that's not quite, no, I shouldn't say that. It is visible from even application level C programs using certain methods. What does the flags register contain? Most of the stuff in the flags register is not relevant to the discussion we are having. It contains the overflow flag, it contains the zero flag, it contains the negative flag. So there's a bunch of stuff in there that is used by programs to control their behavior and control flow and things like that, which is not quite relevant to this discussion. The only little thing in there that's relevant is there is a bit here, which is the mode bit. So I'm using a two-state mode, user and I wrote user on both. I'm talking about user and privilege. If you look at Intel processors, the mode bit is called the ring bits, and it's two bits. It takes values 0001, 1011, and that's why they say we have four rings. And although they have four rings, nobody uses four rings. All operating systems use two rings only. So it's just sitting there doing nothing. So it's equivalent to a one-bit mode register. So one-bit mode register is in the PS. This bit is not changeable by anybody. It's locked down. Okay? There's no opcode that changes it. That's why we can. So if it's set to user, it'll stay user. However, there's an interrupt thing that happens that changes it. So this is one thing we need to add. The other thing I'm going to change is the way the interrupt vector works. Interrupt vector is in RAM and has So this is an array of two integers. So the way I'm drawing it, each slot is one interrupt vector. Each interrupt vector consists of two values, two integers. Okay, so 32-bit machine, that will be 32 bits here, 32 bits there. It has many, many interrupt vectors. There's one interrupt vector per type of interrupt. That means all interrupts are numbered. Okay? So let's assume interrupt number 0 occurs, which is really the clock interrupt is interrupt 0. The keyboard interrupt is, I don't remember, 5 or something like that. So if the clock interrupt happens, then, okay, these two fields are called the PS field and the PC field. I made minor changes. Instead of what I said on the previous slides, an interrupt causes the program counter and the program status to be pushed onto the stack. Then, from the interrupt vector, it loads a program program counter and a new program status onto the program counter and the program status thingies. And then it continues execution. Now, whoever sets up the interrupt vector, which happens at boot time when it comes up in privileged mode and you can access anything, make sure that all the mode bits in the PS field stored in the program status are ones. So when an interrupt happens and you load one of those values into the program status, your mode changes to one. And that's how you change your mode. Can an application program do it? Yes. You can generate an interrupt from an application program. Strangely, you can. If you do that, the mode will change to one. However, the program counter will also change, taking away control from the application and giving it to the operating system. So there is no way you can flip the bit and run your code. It'll always run OS code when you flip the bit. And the flipping the bit is done by generating an interrupt. And it'll flip the bit and go to a prepackaged routine, which will execute. And after that routine executes, it will call a return from interrupt instruction, which will undo everything. So what does the return from interrupt instruction do? So mode was zero. It was running an application program. That program status got pushed on the stack. And the return from interrupt loaded up whatever there was on the stack, putting the mode back to zero. So RTI is the instruction that switches from privileged mode to user mode as a side effect, because it gets the mode bit from the stack. And now I claim you cannot beat the system. Yeah.
Does the prepackaged routine depend on the address loaded in from the interrupt vector?
The prepackaged routine?
Yeah.
The interrupt handler?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Okay, so let me tie that loose end. So the interrupt vector has to be set up by somebody. So here's my RAM. This is my OS start point. When the OS boots, it loads up this interrupt vector at a predefined location. It puts in PC addresses as various functions in the operating system, all of them, and puts a 1 in the mode bit for all of them. And then it goes and does other things, and then it does a RTI to run an application, and then nobody can touch this anymore because the MMU starts interfering with anything you do, and this is in OS memory, so no application can go in and change this. The operating system can change this, but it won't do that. If the mode bit is 1, you tell the MMU to keep quiet. If the mode bit is 0, the MMU works. And to change the values in the MMU, the CPU mode bit has to be 1.
Okay.
So your hands are tied, yeah.
Is the stack part of the operating
system? No, the stack is part of the, sadly, the stack is part of the application process. So yes, all this is going on using the application stack. Now, more modern processors use a kernel stack also, but we won't go in there. Just assume it's in the application, everything works fine. Yeah.
So what if the kernel interrupt has vulnerable code and you can do like bad memory access and flip the...
Yes. If the kernel program has vulnerable code, then all bets are off. That's a kernel vulnerability. So the only way you're going to beat this system is if you run bad operating systems. And the operating systems people constantly patch their operating systems because they do find vulnerable code in the kernel. Okay, so it does take a little bit of time to settle down. Like, how does this work? This is the absolute basics of the lowest level little primitive that's in every computer.
Except this, you said the whole thing is a privileged mode,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
This small thing is the user...
User can't execute that.
Oh, okay, so the user can execute what inside and the privilege can execute all of it?
All of it.
Even the user?
Yes.
Oh.
Because the user part has add, subtract, multiply, jump. Yeah, you've got to execute
it.
Oh. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Which one did you sign up for?
Monday is gone.
Okay. It was a holiday.
This week,
You don't have any. Now, if you sneak into another one, that's okay by me as long as the fire code problem is.
Tuesday, Wednesday, all the 3 days, the recitation will be taken in that same center.
Different timings. I don't remember the timings. But today, I think it's at 6 o'clock. And I don't, 240, I think, BYAC.
Is there an honors contract offered for this course?
Not by default, but if you want one, we can talk about it.
Okay, should I email you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Give me an idea of what you want to do, and we'll go
awesome.
From there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so how do I make sense of this, right? Something like this, wait. I wonder if you can go back to here, I guess. Wait, we want,
We want what? What are you trying to tell me?
Can you go back to this page right here? Never I've been, Yeah, I was kind of sleepy, and I had a
non-process.
Okay, that's true.
So, can you, yeah, I was kind of sleepy there.
That's what I did.
Oh. So, app one tries to,
do a printf, it'll go into the operating system.
Because I don't like the one